from WXXI News. I'm Frank Sigelski, and this is Innovation Friday on Connections. Coming up on this hour of Connections Innovation Friday, Matt Leonard and I will first speak with Professor Dale Jamieson, author of A Reason in a Dark Time, Why the Struggle Against Climate Change Failed and What It Means for Our Future. Later in the hour, we'll speak with Professor Diane Burton from Cornell University, and she'll be talking about an effort to bring creativity, innovation, and entrepreneurship together. We invite your calls at 844-295-TALK, 8255. But without further ado, Matt, how are you today?
Hi, Frank. Nice to be with you again. Okay. Good to be here.
Okay, we'll get to Matt Leonard is the editor of the Innovation Trail Reporting Project. So let's go right to our guest, Dale Jamieson, author of Reason in a Dark Time, Why the Struggle Against Climate Change Failed and What It Means for Our Future. Professor Jamieson, welcome to Connections Innovation Friday.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Okay, thank you for being here. Give us a quick overview of the book. We're talking about climate change, global warming, some of the basic terminology, and the issues that you like to bring to the fore as you debate this subject.
So what's interesting about this to me is that people have understood the basic science of climate change for decades, even really more than a century. And for those of us who were working in this field a long time ago, back in the 80s and the 90s, I think we were all really surprised at how little has actually been done to address this problem. So I really wrote the book to try to understand why that was so, because I don't think we can really think sensibly about the future until we understand why we've failed in the past.
So you've been doing this since before the topic has been politicized, so to speak.
Exactly. That's right. And okay. That's certainly been one of the huge disappointments.
I think in your introduction, Professor Jamieson, you said I think this is a 30-year this is a 30-year book in the making. But there's a sense of urgency, and I guess just for listeners too, Frank, to remind them that we're speaking to Dale on the eve of what's expected to be a pretty significant announcement by President Obama on Monday about federal cap and trade emissions regulations through the EPA. I guess just on that point, Professor Jamieson, do you see, what's your take on where that particular initiative, which, you know, we know hasn't been successful in the past under the Obama administration, what you think of the initiative on its eve?
Well, I think that the president and the administration are really doing everything they can in this period, given that they can't get new legislation. They're acting aggressively through the EPA, they're acting aggressively through other federal mandates, and I think it's going to work, and it's going to make a difference. It's not going to solve the problem, but it's going to help from making things worse than they otherwise are. And it's a little bit like the boy with the finger in the dike. At some point, we are going to need to pass legislation. We are going to have to put a price on carbon. But the things the president is doing are the best that we can hope for in the United States until that happens.
And also, there are 10 states that have already have their own programs in place. States like California, I think Governor Jerry Brown's talked about California as a kind of ground zero for climate change in the states, and they have a plan in place. I'd be interested in your take on, I guess, that sort of state obligation that certain states have taken up the challenge, as opposed to what's going to happen at, you know, when it's kind of imposed from a federal, you know, in a federal mandate.
Right. So I think what happened in the 90s is that a lot of us thought that since this is a global problem, it had to be dealt with at the global level. But it became really clear, particularly after the Copenhagen meeting in 2009, that it wasn't going to be dealt with at the federal level. And then it became also clear that it wasn't going to be very effectively dealt with at the federal level. So the responsibility has just been driven to lower levels of government. And in a way, that's good because it helps people become aware of the issue in a way that they don't when things are much more top-down.
Yes, so Professor Jamieson, just so we get our heads around the topic in terms of climate change, global warming, what do we agree on? What are we still debating? I mean, obviously, if I turn on my air conditioner, I can impact the environment. But beyond that, it seems like there's still some outliers who debate the fact that we can impact the environment. And so how do we figure out what we deal with? Because it's not just about carbon, is it?
No, it isn't just about carbon. But, the problem is that we've been sort of paralyzed by the fact there are a few people who've been denying the reality of human-caused climate change. And I think we really need to get beyond this. I mean, any time that there's a lot of money at stake, there's always going to be somebody taking a pro-industry position. That's just the way things work in a society like ours. But the basic science is really not in doubt and really hasn't been in doubt for a long time. There's details about the extent of the warming, the pace of the warming, things like that that people argue about. That's what science is for. But the basic idea that we need to get on it and we need to act effectively and should have started several decades ago, that's really not in doubt.
Is there still a question about the geologic time piece? You know, the world has been around for however you want to estimate, you know, millions of years or 6,000 years, whatever you want to say, and that in, it's only been in the past couple of hundred that manufacturing and such has created this impact. Is it that drastic that quickly, or are we just, I mean, I don't know, egocentric in the fact that we are making these changes, or is it just a trend?
Well, the Earth always changes. You know, this is a crazy, wild, tumultuous planet on a geological time scale. But what's really different about what's been happening over the last couple of centuries is that the human impacts looked at from a geological point of view are incredibly rapid and incredibly intense. So even though, you know, part of our problem is that from the point of view of a single lifetime, people may not care very much about the future. To really care about this problem, you have to care about your grandchildren. You have to care about the future. To us, that seems like a long time away, but from the point of view of the planet, that's a heartbeat.
Okay. Yes, Dale Jamieson teaches environmental studies, philosophy, and law at New York University, and his new book is called Reason in a Dark Time. If you want to join the show, the number is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Matt, did you want to follow up with a question?
Well, just to move to a slightly different part of the conversation, Professor Jamieson, I was interested. I mean, one of the central questions reading your book that you consider is really what personal choices people have when confronted with the information. You know, I think a lot of people registered the news about the western part of the Antarctic glacier, which is now sort of irredeemably coming away from the continent and likely to have massive impacts on sea levels and so on. And I guess, you know, in the face of such overwhelming and kind of staggering information like that, a lot of people, I know just anecdotally, a lot of people feel kind of, you know, numb or impotent or just really unable to act. So how do you address, what do you think are the things that people can consider when they're trying to make their own ethical decisions around responding to this information?
Yeah, that's, I think, a really deep question. And the first thing I think we need to recognize is that there's a kind of trap here, which is that people deny all the way to the point where they say there's nothing we can do about it. And the space we really need to be in is the middle space, which is, yes, there is something we can do about it. We can't, you know, sort of reattach the West Antarctic ice sheets, that's for sure. But there are things that we can do to adapt to this world, to prepare for it. And also by moving to a low-carbon or no-carbon economy, we can also at least, you know, mitigate or minimize the extent of the damage that's going to be done. But there's no question that we're committed to very radical and very dramatic changes, and we've got to sort of gird ourselves and deal with that. But there's a lot that can be done. If you just look at, for example, Hurricane Sandy in New York, it indicated that we are not well prepared for these events that are going to become the new normal. And even a year and a half past that, we're still not prepared. So there's a lot of work to be done, even though it's not going to turn back, put the glaciers back where they belong.
Right. And I guess I was just talking to a colleague who's doing a lot of work, work on health issues in Tanzania and in the African continent. And her experience is very much about the already massive internal migrations within, you know, across borders, national borders in Africa because of climate change, where agriculture is just no longer sustainable, and it's putting massive pressures on particular countries that have, you know, still have resources or have more stable government structures and so on. So I guess it kind of depends on your frame of reference too. If you're sort of paying attention to that stuff, you're not seeing climate change as something that's still some way off in the future for your grandkids. It's something that's already massively affecting huge populations on the globe right now.
That's right. And the report that was put out a couple of weeks ago by the president really was showing very measurable, quantifiable impacts here in North America. But the point you're making in some ways is even more important. The Department of Defense has put out studies in which they've talked about climate change as being a serious threat to national security because of the way it destabilizes various parts of the world. So that's another thing that we need to pay attention to.
Okay, why don't we go to the phones? We have Jane in the city. Jane, welcome to Connections Innovation Friday.
Yes, I heard, I don't know if it's true or not, but that some of the nuclear testing that we did back in the 50s damaged the ozone. But what I want to talk about really is the fact that we have these disasters like BP. At one time they were saying there was a dead zone in the Gulf, and I haven't heard that in a while. But we've had Love Canal, we've had Three Mile Island, we've had Chernobyl, we've had great, massive destruction in some instances, and it's as though to change things is some sort of sacred cow that we must continue as we always have. And it just, we don't respect the limits of our planet. And I don't know how you go about changing people's minds, that the rigidity, the closed-mindedness, and we have all these propagandists that help them keep their minds closed. But anyway, what do you do? I mean, is it so any limit on a corporation is just their sacred cows? Anyway, thank you.
Thanks, Jane.
Okay, so first of all, here's something we don't do, and then there's something we can do. So the thing that we don't do is just wait to get slapped silly by climate change. Sometimes people say the only thing that's really going to make us change is a lot of pain. But the only thing that really happens when people feel a lot of pain is they get more depressed, they get more demoralized, and often less willing to act. So what we need to do, I think, on the other hand, is to recognize, first of all, it's not just that we're bad people, and it's not just that we have, you know, various kinds of corruptions in our political and economic system. All that's true. But this is a really, really hard problem. Evolution did not build us to respond to the buildup in the atmosphere of a colorless, odorless gas. So it's really going to take all of our political and moral and economic resources to really try to deal with it. It's just that it shouldn't be an issue that divides the right and the left. There's nothing about being a liberal or a conservative that means you should be denying the facts about science.
But it's kind of how those arguments are framed, because just as an experiment, I went on to look at the response, editorial responses to the Obama, the leaked parameters of the Obama plan, and I went to Bloomberg Business News, then I went to the Guardian. In the UK to sort of get a swing shift on that, and you sort of see immediately what the point I think you're making, Professor Jameson, just about the ideological frameworks, which often construct it completely outside the evidence base that the discussion presumably is coming from.
Right. I mean, if we keep politicizing the facts about the natural world, we're going to be arguing with each other as the human species goes extinct. And in a way, that's why I called this book Reason in a Dark Time, because the whole point of reason is to allow us to get past our own prejudices and our own biases and really try to get a grip on reality. And that's really what's called for now. There's no Lone Ranger who's going to save us now. We're going to have to grow up and start acting like adults if we're going to keep this problem from being as bad as it potentially can be.
Professor Jameson, there's another issue out there that sometimes I think confuses the bigger issue, and I can't remember the term, but it's geo-something, and it involves things like putting reflectors in the ocean and battling climate change that way. What, can you speak to that?
Right. So that's what's called geoengineering.
Geoengineering, right.
And here's the story. Geoengineering is sort of interesting because there are people on all sides of the issue who support it, and I think most people are pretty horrified by the thought. But the idea is this, that people who don't like the science of climate change often say, well, if things become bad enough, we can just intervene in the climate system directly. We can put sulfate particles in the atmosphere. We can do iron fertilization and make the oceans store the carbon or whatever. There are some environmentalists who are now so scared and so freaked out about what we're committed to that they're willing to countenance geoengineering as well. Now, I think we have to worry about the old adage of don't jump from the frying pan into the fire. I mean, we've already shown that we're sort of incapable, really, of what you might think are fairly modest changes of behavior, getting off carbon. And if we try to do things that we don't understand very well, to intervene in the entire climate system, that's really like the little boy putting pennies in the light socket that he doesn't understand.
So in a sense, you're saying that it potentially also generates unforeseen problems, or it's a technological fix for a something that needs to be dealt with more at the social level.
Right, and there's another problem here too, which is that it's not our climate. There are countries like India, for example, that are really very dependent on the timing of the monsoon, for example. And there's some studies that show that certain kinds of geoengineering interventions might actually disrupt the Indian monsoon. So even if that makes climate a little better for some people, you're really talking about very, very serious divisions in the international community.
And the geoengineering is more of a response to what's going on as opposed to getting to the root of the problem?
Exactly. And I don't want to sound completely all or nothing. I mean, there's certain kinds of research that are sometimes called geoengineering research that I think it's important to continue to do and to think about. For example, there are some attempts to experiment with withdrawing carbon from the atmosphere. And if we can succeed in learning how to do that in an economical way, even if it takes 300 years to get back to the pre-industrial baseline, it would probably be worth doing in a gradual way. So it's important to keep a very wide portfolio of research going while we do this, but the basic fundamental actions have to be to stop putting the junk in the atmosphere and start preparing for the heavy ride ahead.
Okay. Again, Professor Dale Jamieson teaches environmental studies, philosophy, and law at New York University. His most recent book is called Reason in a Dark Time. He is here. If you want to call, the number is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Professor, the market economy, the free market, emerging economies, how does that play into global policy change for the better?
Right. So there's two issues here. So one issue is really that the countries that got rich first, the European countries, the North American countries, are the ones that historically have been responsible for most of the emissions. So that creates a sense of inequity or injustice when it comes to countries that are now becoming rich, who say, well, you put all that stuff in the atmosphere, we have a right to develop as well. So there's a conflict that's built into this situation, and it is going to require, for example, us to see emissions, carbon emissions in India and China as being different from carbon emissions in the United States or in Europe. We've already done our emitting, and it's going to take them a bit longer to turn the corner. You know, the irony is that on the one hand, China is now the world's biggest emitter. On the other hand, it's also the country that really has the largest renewable energy programs as well.
Now, that's per capita. You know, it'd be interesting to see. Do you look at that? Countries per capita are the largest emitters of carbon? And is that how that's done?
That's not China. China is now sort of in the middle of the pack in terms of per capita emissions. The United States is well above China in per capita emissions. And India is actually very low on a per capita basis. Now, by per capita, I mean by individual person. In fact, here's one way of trying to understand what this means, because it's often hard for us to get a grip on this. Take Brazil, which is one of those countries that we think of as an emerging country, kind of middle-income country. If you fly to California for a vacation and fly back, the amount of emissions that you're responsible for is about the same as the annual emissions of the average Brazilian. So the kind of lifestyle that we all live, that I live, that you live, that probably most of our listeners live as well, is quite a bit above the global average when it comes to emissions. And we need to keep that, I think, in mind when we talk about developing countries and their emissions.
Well, you know, but there are those who would say, well, you know, that those are the fruits of our country's success. Yeah.
it's a little like when I was a kid, you know, the smell of pollution was the smell of money. Did you ever hear that expression?
No, maybe. I don't know. Maybe it's buried somewhere deep in my head.
Buffalo.
The smell
That's
of New Jersey.
People used to say in places like Buffalo and Cleveland. And, you know, there's some truth to that, you know. These industries allowed people to get rich, but at some point you have to make the transition. And if you don't make the transition, then you start getting into a declining quality of life. And that's now happening in China, and people are quite aware of that. that the levels of air pollution, not even talking about carbon pollution now, is actually causing an uptick in emigration of people leaving the country, and it's also damaging GDP perhaps as much as 2% a year.
So just picking up on, getting back to Jane's point, actually, our caller, I think this is kind of inverting what she was talking about, but the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change talks about is this issue of, they're talking about issues of equity, justice and fairness arising with respect to mitigation and adaptation. So in other words, who's actually, you know, in some questions, who's actually bearing the costs of these adaptations, and clearly people who, you know, are currently more economically advantaged, as you were just talking about, Dale, are in a position to kind of, you know, insulate, you know, sometimes literally themselves from, you know, from the ongoing, you know, the ongoing impact of climate change. But then there are also very, I think, very reasonable questions that people say in the Midwest of America might ask, you know, about the impact of, putting harsh emission regulations on their, you know, coal power plant that, you know, that provides all these jobs in a community. So do you want to just talk to that kind of a bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, here, we really have to be honest and we have to be grown-ups. You know, in the 1980s, during the Reagan years, when we began to see the dismantling of the American manufacturing sector, essentially what the government said with a lot of public support was, well, people in these dying industries in Pittsburgh and Cleveland and Buffalo are just going to have to find something else to do for a living. They're going to have to move to the Sun Belt and get into the emerging industries, because it's better for the nation as a whole to, for example, import steel from developing countries than to make it at home. Something like that is true when it comes to coal. Coal is actually, has many attractive properties. It's cheap, for example, that's its main attractive property, but in many ways it's an extremely nasty fuel. It's nasty in the sense that it does environmental damage when it's mined. It kills and damages miners, the people who dig it up. It hurts local communities, as we saw with the contamination of the water supply in Charleston, West Virginia, and it causes global warming. And despite the advantages that coal has, we're just going to have to get over it. And in terms of national policy, we're going to have to take care of people who are going to be hurt by this transition away from coal. But, you know, a lot of things are good for the economy. Smoking was good for some people's part of the economy. It's good for tobacco farmers in the South, for example. You discourage smoking because of its health effects. You've got to deal with the transition. Nothing remains the same.
Right, and I think also you've commented on the kind of role of universities. The story that broke recently about I think Stanford University divesting itself of investments in the coal industry, had pretty widespread, uptake. I mean, how do you view that as a kind of, you know, as an ethical decision by a large influential academy playing out in the debate?
I think it's going to become increasingly common. And it's going to begin with universities, but it's going to spread to all kinds of other institutions and eventually pension funds. And in 10 years, or probably as close as 10 years, people are going to look back and they're going to say, how could ethical and reasonable people ever have thought what they should do is to profit from coal? In much the same way, when we look back at sanctions against the apartheid regime in South Africa, the divestment campaign against that regime looks like completely the obvious thing to do. How could anyone not have supported it when, in fact, lots of people didn't support it, including the Reagan administration in the 1980s? But it's going to look like a historical blind spot, I think, in much, much the same way.
So just before we let you go, Professor Jamieson, just, I guess, just circling back to where we began around individual action, you know, what are things that I think you've talked about, a phrase that you talk about, green virtues, or kind of personal action that people can take? Do you want to just leave people with, I guess, a comment about the role of the individual in this very complicated debate?
Right. So I think that there's things that we can do at all kinds of different levels. So one thing we need to do is to become much more conscious of our consumption. And where our waste products go. And when we buy something or consume something or do something, we have to recognize that we're really taking on that whole burden of the life cycle of that product. At the same time, we can't pretend to have moral purity. nobody is going to go completely off carbon as long as we live in a world where carbon is the lifeblood of the economy. So we have to do what we can. But rather than beating ourselves up for not being perfect, we also have to act collectively and politically and through churches and other kind of educational institutions and so on, because getting off carbon is not going to be something that one individual does or one nation or one industry. It's going to be something that the world does together.
And in fact, it's something that people can achieve much faster at the kind of local and community level than they will, you know, than waiting for their government to act.
Yes, that's right.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Professor Dale Jamieson. Again, he's a professor of environmental studies, philosophy, and law at New York University. And his most recent book is Reason in a Dark Time, Why the Struggle Against Climate Change Failed and What It Means for Our Future. Professor Jamieson, thank you for joining us today on Innovation Friday.
Well, thank you very much. It's been wonderful.
Okay, great. Have a nice weekend. And we'll be back in a flash. I'm Frank Sigelski, and you are listening to Innovation Friday Connections on WXXI AM, WXXI.org. Alrighty, continuing on Connections Innovation Friday, I'm Frank Sigelski, and Matt Leonard is here as well. He is the editor of the Innovation Trail Reporting Project. Our next guest is Diane Burton. She's a professor from Cornell University. So let's get right into what she's going to be talking about in terms of social sciences, studying creativity and entrepreneurship. Professor Burton, welcome to Connections Innovation Friday.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Okay, so let's start with the big picture. This is a new initiative that is part of Cornell University's Institute for Social Sciences, Creativity, Innovation, and Entrepreneurship. Tell us about the origins of the program, what it would like to accomplish, and what it will do over the next couple of years.
Great. Let me step back for a second. Cornell has been undertaking what we're calling STEAM projects for about a decade now. And the idea, it's really an initiative that comes out of the President's Office and the Provost's Office. It's funded by Cornell. The idea is that there are problems in the world that academics should be focusing on, should be addressing, that really require an interdisciplinary perspective. One of the challenges of academia is that we tend to get siloed in our own particular discipline. Economists talk to economists, psychologists talk to psychologists, sociologists talk to sociologists. But there are problems in the world that really require a cross-disciplinary conversation and an interdisciplinary approach. And so I'm leading this year's, it's a three-year project, so this is the 2013 to 2016 theme project on creativity, innovation, and entrepreneurship. But there have been projects before me on poverty, on changing families. There's a current project on contested global landscapes. You know, the idea is these are big issues, big topics, important questions, and we want to focus some of the university's resources and some of the scholarly attention onto them.
So it's just breaking down those silos and creating a multidisciplinary approach to these, quote, big issues, big problems.
Absolutely. And really putting real resources behind it in order to fund research that we hope will be groundbreaking and fundamentally change the conversation that we're having about these topics.
What will you be doing different other than this multidisciplinary approach? What will be doing different that will lead to novel ideas? I mean, you know, there's that concept of if we always do what we've always done, we'll get what we've always gotten. how are you, I hate to say thinking outside the box, but what else are you doing with this theme project?
That's fair. We actually have some big ambitions with this project. If you just, pick the paper, walk through your local bookstore, creativity, innovation, entrepreneurship are the hottest topics. There's an article coming out every day, a new book coming out. Everybody thinks both they're an expert in it, and everyone's looking to entrepreneurship and innovation as the kind of silver bullet that's going to change our economy and change the world. And so as academics, our role is to really step back and examine that critically and examine that skeptically. What is it that we actually know rigorously and convincingly versus, what are the myths that the popular press is purveying? And so some of what we're trying to do is step back and look, really, what do we know? Is breakthrough innovation the product of individuals or is it the product of groups? You can find books that tell you both of those things, right? The lone genius and the power of introverts versus collective intelligence and collective innovation. Who's right? Are there situations under which one is better than the other? So maybe both are sometimes right, but we need to know when and under what conditions. So that's just one example of the kind of question that we're hoping to tackle in our project.
Right. Just on that, hi Diane, it's Matthew Leonard here. I think you're absolutely right in terms of the way that language is out there in the political context particularly, and you mentioned the popular media, and that includes me. So I think it's interesting, and this is a question that we often ask about, the way in which, say, the conversations around innovation are framed. Do you think that they've really been dominated a lot by, I guess, focusing on technology and research and development, and that's become synonymous with what most people think innovation is?
Absolutely, and I would go even further that the current rhetoric and dialogue is linking innovation and entrepreneurship, mm-hmm. and asserting that the engine of novelty and new ideas and breakthrough is going to be new companies and new startups, and that is really potentially the wrong conclusion that we have a long history of established companies being great engines of innovation and breakthrough ideas. And so, again, is it some industries where startups are more generative and more powerful? Is it that the world has fundamentally changed and established companies are no longer able to? Or is it that we're just seeing differences across companies and even across countries?
Right.
What is the engine of innovation? And so one of the concerns we have that is animating our project is this rhetorical linking of innovation with entrepreneurship, which might be wrong, and we might be underselling our largest established companies and our largest established employers. One of the reasons I'm particularly interested in this and think it's really important is that one of the things that we know, hands down, larger established companies tend to be better employers. They tend to provide better jobs, higher wages, better benefits. There's lots of evidence that entrepreneurial firms, yes, they are creating jobs, but there's concern that these are not very good jobs. They have longer hours, so that means, on average, the hourly wages are lower, they're less likely to provide benefits, and I think most concerningly, they're likely to fail and then throw people into a spell of unemployment after they fail. And so the instability of entrepreneurial firms is problematic for employees.
I can see... enormous relevance to Upstate in what you're doing and the kind of what would be influencing the project. I mean, obviously one version of, say, the Kodak narrative is also its inability to deal with innovation, even within its own innovation that it itself had was conducting, and its inability to kind of read the timing of the market and other market forces and so on. And oddly enough, we've got a couple of guys from Xerox coming in after the news, and jokingly, my first question I think is going to be, you guys just make photocopiers, right? You know, so when we know there's all this other, you know, productive research going on inside, but so
no, that's absolutely fair. And with Kodak, that is the canonical example of a company that saw the writing on the wall but wasn't able to adjust quickly and respond to that. But right in our own backyard, we have a counterexample in Corning of a company that was able to respond and is able to continually innovate and reinvent itself as the market changes.
I mean, I think one of the things too, and I wonder what you think about this, is that part of that thing about, you know, innovation being equated with entrepreneurship is that it's seen as a kind of in some ways a quick fix, because there's, you know, the idea of business startups being quick turnarounds, you know. They're just a software app, you know, as a way to kind of drive, drive economic progress in cities that, you know, have lost these legacy industries. It must seem pretty, must seem a pretty handy kind of go-to position for people who want to generate some sense of economic progress.
It's deeply concerning. Really, this is a deeply concerning trend. The idea that, you know, a couple of kids in a couple of hours in a garage can come up with a multi-billion dollar app that's going to change the world. So we see that. We see that in things like WhatsApp, right?
Mm-hmm.
WhatsApp, which was recently acquired by Facebook for $16 billion. But how many people are toiling at apps that are going nowhere, that these people are writing code and investing their life and are not either supporting themselves or likely to create value and jobs? And then if we think about WhatsApp as a company, yes, it created enormous value for investors and for the founders. It didn't actually create any jobs. There
Right.
were fewer than 100 people that were... I might have the number wrong. It was definitely under 200 people that were employed by WhatsApp at the time of acquisition.
Okay, Diane Burton is the team leader of the Creativity, Innovation, and Entrepreneurship Project. She's a professor of human resources at Cornell University. And if you would like to join the conversation, the number is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255.
And I'd especially like to invite anyone who is at the Digital Rochester event that I spoke at yesterday with colleagues from the media here in Rochester. You guys would be very interested to hear you chime in on this conversation, because these are all innovators, local entrepreneurs, Diane. So, encouraging them to call in while we've got time.
Yeah, please do. It sounds like that last thought that you and Matt were talking about, it was about anecdotal evidence versus what's really happening. I mean, everyone hears about, like you say, the two guys in the garage, but is that representative of the types of innovation and change that A, are actually happening, and B, actually benefit society? And I don't want to be, you know, Debbie Downer, like, just because there's a new way to take a picture of your friends at a party and that generates income and blah, 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 that's not feeding the world's hungry people. You know what I mean? There are other issues that I think need to be on the table. Would you agree?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think there are a couple of things going on. We are generally not careful in thinking about what kinds of innovation we're encouraging, we're investing in, we're sponsoring and supporting. If you look at there's the National Venture Capital Association produces an annual yearbook every year that documents what venture capitalists were investing in. And when you look closely at that, you see real trends in particular kinds of businesses and particular kinds of industries, narrowly high tech, but in particular a lot of emphasis on IT, on software, on kinds of products and companies that actually do not use a lot of workers. So they don't create jobs, they don't create good working-class jobs, they don't create good middle-class jobs. In fact, many of the kinds of investments and the kinds of novel things that are being invested in are job-destroying. There was an editorial in USA Today by a colleague down at Duke, Ronnie Chatterjee, who wrote about things like the electronic tolls, right? so that means the job of toll taking is gone, who wrote about Kayak, which is the online search tool for finding airline tickets, which then replaces travel agents.
And but so, just to jump in so there, Diane,
yes, yeah. These are beneficial to consumers, but we have to recognize that they are harmful to employees.
Sure. But just another value you could assess those. I know that biotech, medical technology, biotech projects are a really hot area for venture capital at the moment, and they may have benefits to people who get better health treatment out of the product that the biotech, you know, startup generates. So you don't see the common good isn't necessarily in the jobs created, but you know, the fact that there's capital going into biotech or medical technology can actually benefit the communities in other ways. Would you agree?
Possibly. However, a pharmaceutical company wants a treatment, not a cure, because what a treatment does is creates an ongoing sustainable revenue stream.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what a cure does is destroys that revenue stream.
Yeah, that's important to remember. It's like if the police got rid of all the crime, they'd be out of work. I mean,
exactly.
You know, it's not that amazing concept. But, hey, let's go to the phone. We have phones. We have Tom in the city. Tom, welcome to Connections Innovation Friday. Tom, you're on the air. Shut down your – yep, turn your radio down.
Real quick. Are you okay?
Yeah, turn your radio down in the background, though.
Okay. What I wanted to make my comment is that George Fisher – and Kodak had all the patents for the digital technology. And by some blunder, Kodak is non-existent.
Yeah.
Figure that one out.
Yeah, that's exactly the point we were making.
Yeah, okay. Appreciate the call. What is that? Is there something there?
No, that's okay. Just on Ronnie Chatterjee, though, Diane, he writes, WhatsApp and Twitch employed fewer than 200 people combined. So there you go, just because we're thinking those numbers. Just to move it on, though, so let's talk about some of the people. Who do you think you want to include in the, you know, in this project? Who are participants in this conversation? And then how do you actually broaden it so that, so that it's not just something that's happening at the academic level?
No, fair, absolutely. I have a team of 10 other scholars, Cornell faculty members. Shall I introduce all of them? Or
no, that's okay. What disciplines are they from? That would be kind of instructive.
Yes, absolutely. They are from applied economics, from psychology, from science and technology studies, from the law school, from the sociology department, and from the business school.
So in terms of, I think there's a conference planned for this. What are your aspirations?
There is a conference. So let me just highlight the list of disciplines that I described is actually, it's unusual and surprising.
Mm.
Most entrepreneurship centers and most entrepreneurship research projects tend to be dominated by economists and folks with expertise in finance. And they tend not to be the kind of other social sciences, and in particular, I'm my home base is the ILR school. It's the School of Industrial and Labor Relations,
right. Mm-hmm.
And so in our science and technology studies department, right, we tend to take a slightly different view on business, on the economy, I mean, given where we sit, right? We're taking very much a work and worker perspective, but also the practice of science and the materials that are involved in innovation. You know, it's a kind of step back look at it rather than assuming it is science and technology is always good, beneficial, productive, efficient.
And so that is one of the things that you're doing differently is you're involving a broader spectrum of the sciences, specifically the social sciences.
Absolutely. And also psychology. And so the psychology, and we're particularly interested in both the psychology of creativity and the psychology of judgment. How do we decide whether something's novel, whether it's useful, whether it's valuable? What are the cognitive biases that come into play as people make these really critical judgments about what we think is good, valuable, worthy of investment, worthy of pursuing?
And some of that thought pattern is unconscious.
Absolutely.
Can you speak to the difference between process innovation versus product innovation? In other words, creating new products versus doing things differently with what we already have. Do you get into that at all?
We do. We're focusing more on both process and product. We're really focusing more on breakthrough. And so sometimes people use product versus process as a way of thinking, like kind of differentiating incremental innovation from radical breakthrough innovation. I think that's not quite the right typology. In fact, your question really points to the fact that the word innovation is used to describe so many different things. And so we really are trying to focus on radical breakthroughs, fundamental changes either in what or in how. And so that combines both product and process, and our emphasis is on, transformative, transformational, breakthrough, radical.
Okay. Just on the workplace organization kind of idea, Diane, I'm just wondering whether in your own thinking as well, you're looking at things like innovation can also be equated with notions of reform. So in other words, I know, for example, the city of San Antonio in Texas created an innovation team in 2007, and they're basically looking to improve efficiency, government efficiency. So for them, innovation is actually about reform or cost cutting or finding efficiencies in their business model.
Not think about that as the kind of innovation that we're intending to study.
Right. Okay. Is that a way that a lot of people do you think that's a way that, say, government entities or can sometimes think about innovation, that it's sort of it's basically like a kind of cost-cutting measure, or
Well, I think everybody wants to use the word innovation to describe any kind of change that they're making,
right?
And that's in part because innovation is a sexy topic at the moment. I think we need to be more precise about what we mean by innovation, right? Radical disruptions of the social and economic order is how we're thinking about it. It's a classic Schumpeterian definition, right? This goes back 100 years. There's a precise meaning of innovation that I think has been lost.
Watered down, and it's like, well, you build a better mousetrap, that's innovation, but you're talking about ridding the world of mice or something. I mean, you're at a higher level.
We're trying to be.
Are you involving the private sector, public-private partnerships, or is this all with a mind to getting a finished document or set of protocols that will then go to the market?
We're doing very traditional academic research. So this project is really, the way to think about it is, it's a seed project to come up with new knowledge, new insights that we hope then will inform our curriculum, that will, for our current undergraduate and graduate students, that will inform our outreach with executive education, with extension, right? We do hope. We're a university. Our role in the world is to change the dialogue, change the way people think, change what people do. But our project, this theme project, is really at the level of basic research. We're starting with the most basic questions. Where does innovation come from? How is it best supported and enhanced and sustained? What are the situational and contextual variables that influence it.
Anything jump out right off the bat as you've just started on this that either surprised you or your colleagues?
Our conversation right now has actually almost reflected one of the things that surprised us, which is how varied and how confused and how disparate the perspectives are on the topics of creativity and innovation and entrepreneurship. It feels like a concept that everybody thinks they know what they're talking about, but no one agrees on what they're talking about. And for us, bringing these 10 different people from different disciplines together, there really has been a learning process of us kind of circling around to see where are we talking about the same thing and where are we actually talking about quite different things, and where's the common ground where we harness the power of our collective to make to make real progress.
So just the basic building, what are we talking about? What, you know, what do we hope to impact, things of that nature? That you're really at the beginning.
You're looking at
the whole concept of innovation with fresh eyes, fresh academic eyes, I guess.
Absolutely, and tying it to entrepreneurship and really questioning, should we be encouraging entrepreneurship? What kind of entrepreneurship should we be encouraging? For whom should we be encouraging entrepreneurial action and entrepreneurial behavior? Funded by what mechanism? You know, I think we're watching so many trends. You know, one of the things that I have a student working on now, what are incubators? How do incubators work? Are some kind of incubators better than others? Are incubators even the right way to encourage new ventures and to nurture new ventures?
Music means we're out of time, unfortunately. Do you have a quick question?
No, that's great. Diane Burton is team leader of the Creativity, Innovation and Entrepreneurship Project at Cornell University. She's a professor of human resources studies. And Diane, it sounds like we better be checking back within a year or so, see how you're doing.
I look forward to it.
Thanks very much for joining us from Boston today.
All right. Thank you very much. Again, you are listening to Connections Innovation Friday on WXXI AM, WXXI.org, WEOS, the WXXI mobile app, and WXXINews.org.
I already said that. All right, back in a flash.